It is the Love and Dubcast. I'm Johnny. He's George. Let's get it rolling live and in video.
For the first time ever.
14-year
history. That's of right. The Love and Dubcast.
Why could that be? What would be the reason for me being reluctant to have my face on the internet? I can't possibly imagine. Anyway, so it's me and George, and we've got a lot to talk about. There's a lot of things going on. It's less crazy. I think we've kind of eased our way into the off season. We're starting to dip our toes into the tepid waters of, you know, not having major sports to talk about. But that doesn't mean that the NFL draft isn't going to be happening, that the spring game won't be happening this weekend. There's a lot to kind of dissect and get into. And I want to talk about spring practice from the jump. More crazy Jeremiah Smith stuff. It seems like every picture, every video that we see of this kid continues to be absolutely bonkers. In the past, I think I was pretty reluctant to anoint, you know, especially a wide receiver as the next coming of, you know, of Chris Carter or, you know, David Boston or even Marvin Harrison Jr. or anything like that this early in spring, particularly when a guy should still be in high school. Okay, like that's kind of feels a little premature, but basically everything that we've seen this guy indicates that no, in fact, he is that good. So that's pretty awesome to see. And then you've got Caleb Downs, who there are reports out saying that he's just going all over the place. He's bouncing around the defense, and this is Jim Knowles' new favorite guy. So I don't know, man. How do you feel about some of these newcomers, I guess, but also the prospect of them actually being hits once the season starts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little more reluctant with Jeremiah Smith just because we haven't actually seen him on a college football field yet. With Caleb Downs, it's a little different because you've got an entire sample of work to look at from what he did at Alabama before he came over here. And the guy was able to thrive in the SEC. And you would think that that's going to translate very well to Ohio State, regardless of what role they have him in. But, you know, I always try to be cautiously skeptical, not necessarily in a bad way, not looking for, you know, reasons to be critical, but just because it's our natural inclination as Ohio State fans to expect the best out of the team. And when those expectations aren't met, it's very often that Buckeye fans are felt let down and angry and whatnot.
Sure.
You know, because when you're at a program where the expectation is to compete for a national championship every season, one hiccup can totally compromise the pursuit of that goal. So that kind of has a trickle down effect into evaluating the evolution of players throughout their career here. So, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of other players that have, you know, shown out very, very well in practice throughout their early stages of their career here that haven't necessarily materialized into what some people may be expecting of them. I believe you mentioned, was it Chris Carter's son last week when we were having when we were having a similar discussion about this in terms of like comparing him to Marvin Harrison Jr. for having the pedigree of a NFL Hall of Fame caliber father and then not necessarily panning out just because of work ethic or whatever else relative to development. It's easy to, you know, look at what a player is doing in practice. And if you've played football before, I'm sure that you've probably heard the term quite literally practice player in terms of players that show out in, you know, a simulated capacity in these controlled environments. But then when actually going out and competing for real, for whatever reason, the skills just do not translate. I have no reason to believe that's the case with Jeremiah Smith. And obviously the latest highlight that we've seen out of practice in which he's getting pretty clearly interfered with in a way that Marvin Harrison Jr. had to regularly deal with and is still able to just kind of make one of those like baseball mitt one-handed catches along the sideline of the red zone. I mean, that's special
pretty
stuff.
Wild. So you know what's funny is like there used to be these videos. I think it was like a Gatorade viral campaign that they did where they would show like athletes casually doing insane things, right? And it was all fake. It was all staged. They would simulate it or whatever, or they would just use CGI to try to make it look cool. And you would have stuff where, like, you know, a baseball player would be like talking to a reporter in the outfield, and then somebody hits a line drive at their head and they snatch it out of the air or something like that.
I remember there was one of LeBron like routinely making full court jump
shots.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the most famous ones.
And it feels like every time I see a Jeremiah Smith clip, it feels like one of those ads, right? Like every time I see that, I'm like, this has to be fake. Like on some level, there's got to be something where I'm just not seeing it right, or it's been embellished because of the angle. And then
he definitely has the media members gawking in a similar capacity.
Yeah. Right. And it's funny to see, like, you know, somebody who's super, I mean, you know, usually a pretty sober, guy who does not like get excited easily, doesn't buy into the hype. Dan Hope is a guy who was a very sober, analyst when it comes to this kind of stuff. He's not one to like overhype somebody, and he's like, yeah, this dude's a superstar. So like, if you're saying that, you know, this far into the guy's Ohio State career, when he still really should, you know, by most of, I mean, just by age and by time, would still be in high school as a senior, I think that's pretty special. I think that's pretty cool to see. So I'm excited about that. I also really like how Matt Guerrieri, he was talking about Caleb Downs and used the word special three times in a row. The exact quote was, he's special. He's really special. He's really special. So I think they really think about him. Yeah, I feel like they might think he's special. So I'm excited about that. And look, when it comes to spring, right, what you're trying to get as a fan, and I also think as a coach, you want to know what you can rely on, right, in the fall. You want to know which guys are going to be your leaders. You want to know which guys are going to be your consistent contributors, and you want to know which guys are going to be there on every single play. Ohio State has a lot of talent. They have a lot of returning talent. I think the interesting thing about this team is that even though they have so many guys coming back, a lot of it is talent that is not necessarily been seen as consistent over the past couple years. And what I mean by that is a guy like Travion Henderson, for example, who, again, all the talent in the world, right, but injured a lot and off the field a lot. And you didn't get to see him, you know, on a week in, week out basis because of those injuries. JT Tuimoloau have amazing games and then disappear for two or three games. Jack Sawyer, disappointed for a little bit, but then had two incredible games to end the season. So if you can get all of those guys putting it together on a weekly basis, I think people know what you have the potential to see. What I want to know is who are going to be those guys who bring it every single week that you can rely on to be a superstar. I kind of think back to when I was in college, and the guy that I always thought, whenever I went to a game as a student, that I could just watch and go, this guy's going to just ball out every single game and I don't have to worry about it, was AJ Hawk. Like, I never thought that guy would ever have a bad game because I never saw him have a bad game or even a mediocre game. He was good to great every single game. He brought it every single week. And I want to know who that guy is for the 2024 Ohio State Buckeyes.
Yeah, I would say it's probably more of a issue for the defense than the offense, mm-hmm. which is, you know, in some ways kind of a good thing, because in many ways, like, I mean, you'd rather have that problem with your defense given the level of defense that we've seen from Ohio State the last two seasons. But also, you know, they play a very complicated scheme, and it seems like they kind of have a different featured star, at least in terms of a top performer from game to game. That's the way that it really felt last year. But mm-hmm. at the same time, we've talked about it before, the pass rush left a lot left to be desired relative to actually, you know, finishing with sacks. I would say it's a bit of a different story on the offensive side of the ball, just because it's more about injuries relative to consistency. You already brought up Travion Henderson's sporadic unavailability, but Emeka Egbuka was a similar story last year, and you can, you know, I spoke at length last week about my concerns with anointing Devin Brown as the starter long-term relative to his own health issues. So I would say, absolutely, on the offensive side of the football, if you're going to talk consistency issues for this team, it's probably more of a health matter than anything else. I think Travion Henderson, when he's been out there, has routinely been a pretty significant difference maker for this football team. So it's right. not necessarily about him being given opportunity and not doing anything with it as much as just being consistently present on the field for Ohio State. And I think the same thing can be said about Emeka Egbuka, although it's going to be interesting to see how he does now in a position where he's going to be called upon consistently as the wide receiver one, as opposed to playing alongside Marvin Harrison Jr. Now, he had to do that rather unexpectedly against Notre Dame last year, and thrived might be a strong way to put it, just relative to what the offensive performance was for both teams in that Notre Dame game. But he was very clearly a crucial component of the success that they did have in that game, and one of the reasons that they were able to win. So I think that he can deal with that pressure. And if he's going to be having a supporting cast like Brandon Innes and potentially now Jeremiah Smith, you know, backing him up, and other members of the receiving core, which is especially it's something that I'm going to be curious about, is that, you know, this perceived ascension of Jeremiah Smith, how is that going to shake up the receiver rotation, given that there's always a lot of mouths to feed in that room, but we've seen how that has kind of resulted in not washing out, but some talent recognizing that in order to actually get the workload that they think that they deserve relative to what they can show, they may have to go find another opportunity at another school. So I'm curious to see how that's going to kind of shake out.
Yeah.
But yeah, my overall point here is I'm less worried about consistency relative to the offense than I am about health. But I do think that for select parts of the field on defense, that consistency in terms of production is going to be something worth monitoring. I did think last year the secondary was pretty consistent from all players that were out there on a
I thought they were great.
But Denzel Burke obviously had a bit of a fluctuation from his freshman down to his a bit of a sophomore slump before coming back into his own last year. So it'll be interesting to see if he's able to continue that consistency rather than falling back as he did when he was an underclassman here at Ohio State. But I'm beyond the pass rush. I'm not as concerned about consistency, I think, for all parts of the defense as much as just with that front seven.
You know, Emeka is a really interesting case. And I do think that, I mean, when you look at the talent overall, right, it's not like it's a super deep wide receiver room in terms of numbers, right? They're not like stacked with like 40 dudes or anything like that. But the guys that they do have are really, really, really good. And you're right about that transfer portal window. I think that opens up right after the spring game. I think it's like the 16th or something like that. There are going to be some guys who make some decisions, and it's going to be really interesting to see how they handle just personnel and figuring out what they have and what they're going to do with what they have. Emeka, you know, he didn't have a single 100-yard receiving game last season, which isn't a crime. I mean, he still had, you know, a couple of like 90
yards. More of an
yards.
Indictment on McCord than anything else, I think.
Right, right. Exactly. I don't think that's on Emeka, but there were definitely games where, you know, he had one or two catches and that's it. Against Michigan, he only had 3 catches for 25 yards. Like that's a problem, right? And again, is that all on him? Of course not. I mean, he was, you know, being thrown to a guy who basically his progressions went Marvin, nobody, right? Like that was kind of his whole thing. And that's part of why, you know, he's no longer at Ohio State. And, you know, it's finding that rapport with whoever the quarterback's going to be and figuring out and making a decision. And this is, of course, on the coaching staff, making a decision about who's going to be that starter is really important to get right and to get right early, because you don't want a situation where you have all of this talent, but then they can't get on the same page as the guy who's throwing the football. And that's a problem. And so you got to make sure that you head that off at the pass and figure out a way to determine who your guy is going to be as early as possible, because I really don't think Ohio State can take a quarterback competition going into the season. I don't think that's advantageous for anybody. I think they just kind of have to kind of, you know, pull the ripcord and figure out who's it's going to be. going into fall camp. So we'll see how that works out.
We can't get to the end of September and still be running a two quarterback system.
Oh God, no, given absolutely not. Absolutely
relatively
not.
Soft schedule that Ohio State is going to have early on.
So
it's not going to fly.
Speaking
but
of that,
again,
then, George,
with the receiver rotation, I'm looking at it right now as Igbuka is clearly number one, but mm-hmm. then who's going to go into that two role? Was it supposed to be Carnell Tate? Was
it could
supposed to be Brandon Innes? Is it going to be Jeremiah Smith now? And what are their three attitudes about who gets to fill that gap on top of whoever else may be behind them that presumably thought they were going to be able to maybe sneak into that wide receiver three role? It's they may be a little bit thinner than they have been in recent seasons, but there's no shortage of talent, and I'm sure that they're all eager to be fed. So I'm just curious about what their feelings are around this situation where there's so much star power already being anointed to Jeremiah Smith based on what we've seen in practice.
Well, and and we've talked about the wide receivers, but there's a similar situation happening with the running backs too, right? I mean, there's been two articles that we've had on the website about Dallin Hayden and TC Caffey, and it's like nobody's even thought about those dudes since Quinton Judkins came to campus. And it's not, again, not a slam on those guys. I love Dallin Hayden. I think he's
most
very
people
good.
Wrote off that Hayden was going to transfer as soon as the season ended.
That's exactly. Still, and so
he's
I don't
still here.
That's right. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know. The dynamics here are really, really interesting. So that leads to the question that I have for you, which is how much do you think we can actually glean this Saturday from the spring game? In other words, do you think it's going to be a good indicator of where the coaches' heads are at in terms of, the guys that are going to get starter reps, the guys that are going to get backup reps, stuff like that? Or is it just like, this is a glorified, scrimmage that nobody really can put too much stock in? How much do you think we can actually get from it on Saturday?
It is a glorified scrimmage.
But does it mean anything?
It's a pep rally dress rehearsal that happens 5 months before the actual seasons begin. So it's the same thing I was saying with March, and that it's too early to be drawing, I think, really big finite conclusions about what the personnel rotation is going to look like. What you should be looking at for, if you want to get excited about something, this is, I think, the more compelling spring game than we've had in quite some time, if for no other reason that we just want to see what Chip Kelly's offense looks like at Ohio State.
Right.
That's what I think you need to be looking at. And, just the different way that they're blending the run with the pass. And we keep hearing that, this is going to be a more run heavy, I think, approach than we're used to just because of what Chip Kelly's orientation is. But I still want to see it given the talent that Ohio State has in the receiver room. I'm hoping that we get to see, all of the quarterbacks that are potentially in the battle here, getting to contribute and kind of show what they're potentially capable of this season. But obviously not all of them are going to be getting reps against the first team defense. And you're still in a situation where they're not actually having to deal with the adversity of a live pass rush and getting to see what they're, how they're capable of executing when under fire, which was, I'm not going to pretend like I've got a photographic recollection of how the spring game was last year, but it seemed like most of the consensus was that McCord should have been the starter over Brown anyway going in, but you were never going to have to see McCord actually deal with the pressure of potentially getting hit in the way that we did not see him deal with very well down the stretch of the past season when they actually went live. So it's tough to judge a quarterback's ability to deal with that pressure in a simulated game like this. So I don't think that you can make finite conclusions about who should end up being the starting personnel so many months out, given that they're not going to be dealing with that sort of adversity. But if you go into this game just with an open mind into what are the differences in the offense that we're potentially going to see in these early stages relative to how the season ended last year without Chip Kelly, I think that you'll come away satisfied in terms of what you were trying to gleam out of this for the future of Ohio State.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know what? It's going to be a beautiful day on Saturday. At least the forecast says it is, 66 and sunny. $10 gets you in the door. You know, and I've always liked the spring game just from the perspective that it's the game for the common man. If you can't get into Ohio Stadium to see your favorite college football team because it costs you, you know, $300 just to, you know, to get to the stadium, to park, to eat a hot dog and to watch a game. And maybe that's a little beyond your means because it's beyond a lot of people's means. Then I think this is a really good opportunity to do that at a reasonable price. Now, I would like it if it were like free. I think that would be cool. But $10 is, you know, I think that's okay. So
you don't run a revenue record setting athletic department with a free spring game. Come on,
that's right. That's right. How do you think Ohio State got these huge revenues? Through television contracts? No, it's through spring game ticket sales. That's how they get to where they're at. Okay. That's how they maintain their position.
Where do you think they got that NIL money for Caleb?
That's right. That's right.
Julius.
Yeah. So I'm all about the spring game. It should be fun this year. And I think there's, you know, as you said, there's a lot to pay attention to, but probably maybe more schematically than personnel wise. Speaking Absolutely. Of personnel, however, let's talk a little bit about Ohio State men's basketball. We got some transfers, some guys coming back. First of all, Zed's gone. Zed Key. He had one more year of eligibility. After 4 years, he's moving on, which is, you know, it's a little sad. I always liked Zed's energy. I always thought he was fun. I think he was most fun as a freshman. And then, you know, as it became increasingly clear that Chris Holtmann had no idea what to do with the dude, it was a little less fun watching him kind of flounder in the offense. And, you know, I think he's a talented basketball player. I think he'll be able to go off and do some good things wherever he ends up. But it kind of makes sense that he, you know, was going to look for greener pastures. Devin Royal is going to stick with Ohio State for his sophomore year. So that's kind of cool. Roddy Gale is going to be transferring, and Michi Johnson is back. So the prodigal son returns. And that's gonna, so all of this combined, first of all, means that they're losing a lot of shooting, with Middleton gone now and all these other guys, they're losing a lot of shooting. They really got to find a guy who can get the three ball, you know, out of his hand and into the basket. I don't know, man, this is going to be really interesting. It's going to be a test. We've talked about this. It's going to be a test of Diebler's ability to build a program, because now he's going to have to do that through the transfer portal, and he's going to have to do it quickly because they're missing a lot of production at this point.
The departure of Zed is one that could potentially, when we look back in the grand timeline of Ohio State basketball, I hope it represents a changing of the guard moment relative to the expectations for big men that walk through the doors of this university. Because, and I kind of spoke on this last week, but for a very long time, going back to Thad Matta, the trend for big men playing on this team has been a lot of undersized, awkward lefties. And while Zed Key, I think for at least, certainly the first few seasons he was in Columbus, I think that, you know, in terms of like these awkward tweeners, he certainly fit that mold. And I felt so
bad. They had him going against
him.
Zach Edey, man. Like,
he was
that,
the reason
point,
they beat Purdue.
Yeah. Which is
like
insane.
He had like six steals and was swatting the ball out of Edey's hands on like every other possession. Like,
yeah, which is
no doubt.
And that ruled, but like, that's not a consistent recipe for success.
No, you can't expect that many steals from your big man. But I felt for him so bad just because he worked so hard to reshape himself and make himself more lithe, if you will. Lithe.
Lost
one of those
a ton of weight.
I've only seen written, never said out loud. But he reinvented his body going into this season that was pretty clearly going to be his last one in Columbus, regardless of what the outcome was. And like, he really didn't get rewarded by Holtmann for that, I think, to the extent that he should have been. It, you know, and this team, which had much higher expectations going in than they were obviously able to live up to under Holtmann, it stinks to see that guy put in that kind of work and get let down the way that he did. So I am, right. I am very sad to see him go, not just for, you know, the entire, the meme that he was over the course of his time in Columbus, but also because he was someone that was a veteran presence on a team that did not deliver to the expectations that it had for it, not necessarily through any fault of his own, but he put the work in to where he should have been rewarded for that and really didn't get to enjoy the fruits of his labor. They'll always have that upset over Purdue, and I'm sure that if Purdue, as we're recording this on Sunday night, if Purdue ends up winning the national title tomorrow night, they'll be able to look very fondly back on that win for the rest of their lives. But obviously, I think they would have even traded that in for an opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
It's tragic to see him leave, but I'm hoping that as Okpara comes back and we're, you know, preparing to go into the Diebler era, that we start to see more of a trend of big men coming to Columbus that fit the Okpara mold rather than the Zed Key mold. No more Evan Ravenels. No more Dallas Lauderdales.
Oh, no. I would hate that. I love Dallas Lauderdale. Don't you dare.
I want seven footers that are rim protectors and consistent dunkers. I don't want these tweeners that are like too thick to play forward, but not tall enough to play center. Yeah, I'm done with it.
So I think Ravenel and Dallas Lauderdale were serviceable for what they were. I think the issue, though, is that Holtmann never figured out what to do with Zed Key. Like, I don't think he ever figured out how to integrate him in the offense. You know, the idea was like, oh, he's going to be a, you know, like a post-up shooter or something like that. Obviously, that's insane.
He's going to be a three-point shooter this season.
Yeah. Yeah, they were like, they were hyping up his three-point abilities, and like, nobody bought into that. Nobody bought into that because they knew it was stupid. And so, like, I agree with you, man. I do feel bad for Zed because I don't think he was ever really evaluated correctly, developed correctly. He can play basketball. He can contribute, but he's got to find a system that can, you know, suit his strengths. And Ohio State just never was able to do that for him. And it really
the
stinks.
Dunk he had at the beginning of the Michigan game was one of the best I've ever seen from an Ohio State player.
It ruled. It was amazing. It set the tone for the entire game. It was awesome. They needed more of that, and they just never figured out how to do that. So, you know, I wish him all the best, and, you know, anybody else, you know, Roddy Gale going, et cetera, you know, anybody who's going, you know, hopefully you find a place that allows you to thrive and to be great. But this is, like I said, this is now Diebler's, this is Jake Diebler's team, but more importantly, it's his program. And so now you've got to figure out a way to, you know, get some better personnel, get some guys in through the transfer portal, because if you don't do that, you're going to be behind the eight ball really, really, really quickly. You're losing a lot of production going into the next season.
And this is already where the Dusty May comparisons come in, because there's already a talent exodus that's happening from Florida Atlantic and a lot of speculation that some of those guys are going to end up in Michigan. And you just
wonder. I'm sure they will.
At Ohio State opted to go with Dusty May, how many of those guys that are transferring out of Florida Atlantic right now would potentially be candidates to come in and fill in the gaps at Ohio State?
Right. I would imagine a lot of them. And that's the issue. And so you're going to have to figure out a way, if you're Diebler, to mitigate that a little bit yourself by going to the transfer portal and finding some dudes. So we'll see how that goes. It's going to be an interesting offseason, to say the least. So we're going to get to Ask Us Anything, but before we do that, I want to remind you that the Dubcast is sponsored by the Dry Goods Store at 11warriors.com, drygoods.11warriors.com, shirts, hats, stickers, check it out. It's great. It's awesome. I got to tell you, okay, it's getting a little warmer. You can buy the t-shirts. You can wear the t-shirts in public. I know you, George, live in Miami where it's perpetually t-shirt weather, but like here in Ohio, it's starting to
wearing, you know, a hoodie right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can,
as the viewers can all see, the that's listeners right and the viewers for the first time ever,
that's right. But here in Ohio, it's actually you know, it's getting into shorts weather a little bit, I guess. 70s. It'll be 70s tomorrow. But then the
sun's going to be.
Yeah, but then the sun's going to be obscured by the moon, and, you know, cats will lie with dogs, and, you know, frogs will fly.
The long overcast of Ohio State sports off season.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The eclipse will happen, and we'll all turn inside out, and I don't know. Anyway, so let's do Ask Us Anything. You can ask us literally anything. Literally anything. We may not answer within literally reason. Anything, but you could ask us literally anything by sending us questions to dubcast@11warriors.com. Let's go ahead and start with this first question from Bill. Hey guys, Bill asks. Hey guys, I always like the little Bill, you know. Bill, hey, hey, Bill, dudes. Hey,
Bill,
bro.
Bill.
Bill wants to know, what are our favorite conspiracy theories? Now, I feel like we might have answered something like this similarly before, but I want to bring up a couple that I haven't talked about on the Dubcast that I really enjoy. And I know you've got one that you really are all about, George.
Hey, give me one of yours, and then I'll say mine, and then you can
okay. with your other so one. I like the ones that are like really bonkers and don't involve like something really horrific and dire. Because a lot of conspiracy theories are, if they're not like outright depressing, they're, you know, like low-key like racist or bigot or something. I don't like any of that stuff. That's not fun. It's sad. It just makes me angry. The stuff I like are things like the Denver airport conspiracy theory, where people are freaked out by the
okay, we definitely haven't talked about this because I haven't even heard of this.
Yeah, this one's really fun. So some people think that the Denver airport's like a staging area for the New World Order when they like try to take over the world. And the way you know this is because there's like a really creepy like horse statue with like red glowing eyes out in front of the thing. Oh, and then also God. Like the way the airport's laid out. And there's also a of creepy mural inside. Yeah. And I just really like the implication that like, if there's some shadowy organization that's going to try to take over the world, that they would leave hints about it. They would just be like, no, we're going to take over the world, but we're going to be like really coy about it. We're going to be like, you figured it out.
Well, that's what the elites do, is they mock the underlings because their intelligence isn't, but they leave little hints and they hide in plain sight.
They hide in plain sight, and so that's why they make creepy horse statues.
They could pick a more evil, sinister airport than Denver, though. Like O'Hare,
I know,
or Atlanta.
Yeah. It seems a little odd. Charlotte, that Denver would be the staging area for this. But that's one of my favorite ones. That one's really fun.
Denver doesn't crack my top five for evil airports.
No, there are way more evil airports than Denver.
Oh yeah.
O'Hare is probably like the most evil,
but that's the whole basis, is just because of that horse statue.
Yeah, well, there's also a creepy mural, which I think they've since taken down actually because it was really goofy and weird, but like, yeah, that's basically it. It's the, yeah, and people are like, can you and there's a lot of like 2007 2008 era YouTube videos about it where it's no, yeah, but it's like, it's, you know, it's like some teenager trying to over enunciate every word to sound really, you know, professional. Like, did you know that in Denver airport there are murals that are creepy and weird? And they talk and they do like the ASMR thing because it's like they're talking really close into the mic and they're like, did you know that the red eyes signify the devil? And it's pretty funny.
And they've got like that soundscape 2009 song.
Oh yeah, they're playing like in the background, they're playing like,
it says unregistered hypercam too. That's up right, in the,
yeah,
right,
that's right, corner. Unregistered hypercam in the bottom. Yes, that's exactly what it is. When I used to teach a class about conspiracy theories when I was a high school teacher.
Oh,
and,
that's so cool.
I had
paid to do that. That's amazing.
Oh, it was great. And I had a like a YouTube like list that I had made of like 100 or so conspiracy theory videos that I just found on YouTube that I thought were hilarious. So. Orbs are really good. I found a lot of really great orb videos of people who are filming orbs in their backyard.
Oh yeah. Orbs are,
which is just dust.
I've been terrified of orbs since that SpongeBob episode with Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy and the Orb of Confusion.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are powerful, man. You got to watch yourself around those.
That's right.
Okay, SpongeBob, so I have two, and neither one of them are really sinister. I think one of them is much funnier than the other, but the thing is, like, they're so, like, I even though they're conspiracies, I'm convinced that both of these things are totally accurate. So okay. I actually go above and beyond in terms of grading them as conspiracies as much as just like this is the reality that our society has refused to embrace. So the first one is that John Rockefeller's son was not eaten by cannibals, but actually joined the cannibal
yes,
tribe.
Yes, I've heard this one. Okay, yeah.
There's literally video of him, like, long after he was pronounced dead, like, rowing with them in their, like, ritual out in, like, Indonesia or Papua New Guinea.
I think we have
whatever.
Talked about this. Maybe we talked about it off.
I think we might have talked recording. About it off air. But
I think talk about it off air.
I'm totally convinced that it would have been such a bad look for one of the Rockefeller children to forsake their inheritance
oh, yeah, of course.
And family name to go live with the savages in the jungles of East Asia.
Right.
And so John Rockefeller willingly had the media pronounce his child dead as opposed to having the world
to
know
live
the
with
horrible
the
truth. Yeah, right. Exactly. So I'm totally convinced that.
Who wouldn't want to be a robber baron? Jeez.
There's a video of like all these East Asian islanders are like rowing in this canoe or big boat or whatever. And then there's like one white guy with like very curly brown hair and like the goggles that a person wearing glasses like Rockefeller's kid did would
he's
be
wearing an I Heart NYC or yeah like t-shirt.
Well, no, he's wearing like the loincloth and he's dressed just like all them, but he's got the goggles on and it's like there's nobody else that would have access to those. So I'm totally convinced that one is real. But the other one that I'm convinced is real, which is much funnier, is that Justin Trudeau is the son of Fidel Castro. The resemblance between those two is uncanny. There is no way that it didn't happen, that Margaret Trudeau did not cheat on her husband while they were visiting Cuba. Yes. Right. And Fidel Castro was the savviest of ladies' men. It was... I am totally convinced that Justin Trudeau is Fidel Castro's kid. Absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt. And it explains why he has like a weird relationship with like blackface too.
Oh yeah, he does. Yeah, god, there's a lot of like crazy stories of Justin Trudeau and that. I don't, you know what though, and this is, I mean,
there's a lot of racial identity issues because
here's the other thing. No, but here's the thing that drives me, this is what I think's really wild, this is like a whole other tangent. What the hell's with Commonwealth countries and that kind of thing? You know what I mean? Like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, they are totally cool with doing like the most racist, insane crap like that, where they're like, yeah, they're like shows that well into the 80s and 90s did blackface in like Australia and New Zealand, where they're just like, yeah, it's hilarious. And I'm like, what is wrong with you people? Yeah, so... Yeah,
I was not aware of this, but
yeah, dude, it's sheesh. Nuts. There's actually this really Harry Connick Jr. is it's Harry Connick Jr. right? From
asking a 30-year-old this question.
It's fine. He's a singer from New Orleans, and he's on this Australian like it's like the Gong Show basically, and it's in the 2000s. I think it's like early 2000s, like 2004, 2005. And
you say these... Australian like an actual Australian.
And anyway, there's this like Jackson 5 tribute group that come out on this Gong Show thing, but they're all like in blackface and it's the most hideous thing ever. And of course, Harry Connick Jr. is just like, bomb, like he's hitting the gong and he's like, no, man, that's insane. What is wrong with you? And it's apparently that group had been performing to the delight of Australian audiences for years and years and years. And the crowd was super into it. It's just creepy, man. I don't know why that's such a big thing in these Commonwealth countries. It's really weird. Not to say that the United States doesn't, you know, have people do that stuff, but oh my god, just freaking crazy. Anyway, next ask us anything question. So this is from Keith. Keith wants to know, and this is with the spring game coming up, what is our favorite or, well, he says most memorable, but I would say, is there a memorable spring game performance? One that we really hanged our hat on one more that we can remember. I actually have a couple that I can remember because I wrote about it.
They change the rules so often now that I honestly can't place one.
No. Well, there used to be, I mean, the spring game used to be like a game, right? Back in, you know, the trestle era, it was like, okay, you guys are going to put on your pads and we're going to hit and we're going to have a real game here. We're going to try to make it a facsimile of something that you might actually do. And I remember Ray Small, of all people, had two incredible spring games where people were like, this is it. He's made the leap. He's going to be, you know, one of the best wide receivers in the Big Ten. And of course it was a mirage. I mean, it wasn't something that actually ever happened, but I do remember specifically Ray Small, and maybe that's why I'm always like reticent to, you know, to put any stock in anything that happens in the spring game. But yeah, Ray Small had two spring games where he was just dominating people, like mossing them and stuff. And I'm like, okay, maybe this is legit. And of course, you know, like I said, it wasn't, but I just always thought it was interesting. And I attended a couple of them where he was great. And I'm like, damn, you know, this guy. There was another dude. There was a wide receiver. Oh God. I think it was Ty Hamilton was the guy's name. He was like 6'7". He was gigantic. And same deal. Like he had a great spring game. He was 6'7". So he was literally just like picking the ball up, you know, and, you know, just grabbing it over guys' heads. And I was like, okay, this guy, he's going to go in and he's going to be amazing. And, you know, couldn't run, right? He couldn't run a route and then didn't end up, you know, translating anything in the fall. But
like it was Garrett Wilson and Jigba or somebody had one that was like crazy when they were a freshman that caused like a similar Jeremiah Smith effect to what we're seeing now in recent seasons.
Dontre Wilson had a few where he was, you know, looking really good and you're like, let's go. Hey man, and that's what I'm talking about. Like that's really to me the thing about the spring game that I actually kind of enjoy. Like I know these guys aren't necessarily going to go out and do crazy stuff, but I love it when some unknown dude just does something nuts and he looks like he might, you know, he might show these guys.
Dontre Wilson has like 10 or 15 different highlights that were like one step away from being like memorable touchdowns throughout his Ohio State career, where he just falls like short of making a spectacularly memorable play.
He had like three of those against like me. He had one crazy Michigan State game. He did really good against Michigan State one year. And then he had several almost Michigan State games where it's like, if you just put your foot in bounds, that would have been an 80-yard touchdown or something like that.
But I mean, that's another great example of like a player that carries a lot of hype based out of practice performance and perceived pedigree from high school going into Ohio State that just for whatever reason through sheer, it's not like we all recognized how talented the guy was, but just through sheer circumstance or bad luck, the talent just doesn't end up translating consistently to competitive situations. So that's why it's important to have measured expectations relative to guys like Jeremiah Smith.
Right.
I mean, we all see the talent in a controlled capacity right now.
But what does it look like when you're on the field?
Right. And when you're, you know, live at the next level for the first time. So
100%.
It's, you know, the Dontre Wilson rule, perhaps we should call it, of measured.
I like that better than the Ray Small rule. So that's Ask Us Anything. Keep sending those questions into dubcast@11warriors.com. Let's talk a little bit, some basketball going, and, you know, as we exit out of the Dubcast this week. So we're recording this, as George mentioned earlier, on Sunday. Women's basketball just had their national championship. South Carolina, you know, it was it was lopsided in the first quarter. Iowa was looking really good. It was tight going into the half, and then South Carolina just kind of dominated the second half. Caitlin Clark, you know, like, okay, scored 30 points, but I think she took like 25 shots to get there, something like that. I don't know if Iowa had any bench points. South Carolina had something like 30 plus. They're just a better team. That was basically it. I don't even think it was really that close. I think they won by something like 12. And as good as Caitlin Clark is, like, you can't just keep chucking up shots. Somebody else has to make something. So it was, you know, it was a great half of basketball, and then South Carolina just kind of leaned on them and won. But you know, shout out to them and Dawn State. I mean, holy crap, that undefeated season, a really, really young team. And I don't know, I mean, at this point they've won what, 3 out of the last 7, something like that. So they're killing it. It's been, and I will also say, I the thing I love about all of this with Caitlin Clark and South Carolina and all these other teams,
I think this is one of the best seasons for women's basketball in a very long time since the, you know, the end of the dominance of UConn and Tennessee and all them. I feel like there's been kind of a void and that's been filled. And I know it sucks because, you know, Caitlin Clark is not going to be there next year, but I like that women's basketball has gotten the kind of attention that it really has deserved this season. I think it's awesome. So it was a great season from everybody and a cool way to end it.
Well, the interesting thing about like this season relative to, it's funny you bring up the UConn era, like UConn, it wasn't just that they went undefeated. It's that they had like star power between.
Yeah. Yeah, Maya exactly.
Moore. Like they, that I think is what garnered a lot of the attention was not just because they were undefeated, but because, you know, they had,
you knew who was on that team,
that were their own brands. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily have that with the South Carolina team, which is unfortunate because I really, really enjoyed watching them play basketball today. Like they played as a complete team. I mean, they are a deep team with a lot of size for the women's game, and they really put on a complete performance that spoke to, you know, the grittiness that you need to go 38-0. They got in a double digit hole very early in the game, did not get discouraged by the haymakers that Caitlin Clark hit them with to come out of the gate.
Yeah, she's shooting shots back from like the logo and yeah, doing all kinds right. of crazy stuff.
But, you know, we're two of the biggest Caitlin Clark haters out there, if you want to call us that, I think. And
I'm just a skeptic. I'm not a hater. I'm just a skeptic.
Yeah, I think that's a better way to word it. The thing with me is that, you know, I grew up a Chicago Bulls fan, so I have a ton of sympathy towards Michael Jordan. And then I went to college at Ohio State, so I spent a very, very great deal of my life defending Michael Jordan as the GOAT from people that were readily trying to anoint LeBron James as such. And I saw a very similar effect here in terms of people just trying to declare that because Caitlin Clark is pulling up from 30 feet routinely, that she's got to be the GOAT. Now, she did, across these two national championships, she shot like 13 of 32 from deep, which is above 40%, which is extremely good.
Yeah.
But overall, she also shot only like 19 of 50 from the field in two title games. I don't think you can call that a GOAT-worthy performance. And it was funny. One of my other friends that has been a very routine, kind of as a meme, Caitlin Clark hater, like invoked some a catchphrase that people would use for LeBron today when he said, "How can she be the queen without a ring?" So it's, you know, kind of a similar story there, I think.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. I get it. You know, she had two opportunities to kind of seal a deal in the national championship game and came away empty.
But it is, it certainly was the strong, I mean, last season I thought ended very strongly for women's basketball too, but it certainly, you know, star power is what is going to fuel sports through anything else rather than these undefeated teams. And I think that, you know, when we look back at like the attention that UConn era got, it really becomes more of a product of the faces that they had coming out of that program and going into the WNBA rather than
the coaching.
The fact that they went on the winning streak that they did, because South Carolina is like 118-3 in their last like 121 games, and it feels like nobody really cares. They just want to see Caitlin Clark pull up from the logo.
Right.
That's really why people are tuning in. So it'll be interesting to see. I know I'm drawing a blank on the player at USC that everybody is anointing as like the next great one in women's college basketball now. And I think Paige Buchers has at least one more season at UConn before she goes pro. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting to see how, with, you know, one of the all-time greats in women's college basketball leaving now, how the star power gets or translates into next season, or if, you know, it fills as much of a void. I think another thing too was, you know, I to the point, like, I know LSU didn't necessarily have the defense that they wanted, but I mean, Angel Reese was obviously a big star in her own right too, coming out of the national championship win last season. And there were a lot of people that were craving that inevitable rematch with Iowa that we ended up getting. So now that you've got the two biggest names from last season that translated into this most recent season departing, it'll be interesting to see who ends up filling the void. I think Paige Buchers is kind of already there just because she's at an established brand like UConn and has already had a lot of success in her own right. But it'll be interesting to see if the, if we get more than, I think, one star into next season, because there's a need to have, I think, multiple stars as opposed to just one across several teams for continuing this kind of momentum. But I think women's basketball is in a better place than it's perhaps ever been.
Oh, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, the numbers and the, you know, the viewership and all that stuff, I think, speaks for itself. I will say that it's going to be, I think, difficult, because one of the big draws with Caitlin Clark is that, okay, she might pop off for like 40 or 50 every game. And that was, I think, what really kind of drew people to it was this,
right?
You know, it's this thing that you're going to see that you don't normally see. And, you know, not to take away anything from, you know, any of the other people, you know, who are playing the sport, but you don't see that, right? That there isn't a player like that, I think, like Caitlin Clark. And that's tough. That's unfortunate, but I think that's part of why people were tuning in so much.
And part of the reason why I think people were readily anointing her the GOAT too is
she's exactly
doing things we've never seen before.
Yeah.
She did set the tournament scoring record, but
yeah,
I'm sure she would have traded that in for a national championship.
I'm sure she would have. Speaking of national championships, so we're recording this again on Sunday, so the national championship for men's will be tomorrow. We got Purdue, we got UConn. I'm excited about the matchup. That's kind of what I wanted once the Final Four was set, because these are the teams that have been playing the best throughout the tournament. Purdue did not have an awesome game against NC State. It was actually kind of dire to watch. They played really good defense, and then it was basically just the Zach Edey show, and you know, whatever. It was like one of those like 50-40 type slogs where you're just like, why am I watching this? And then UConn took care of business after struggling a little bit in the first half. I don't know. How do you feel this one shaking out? I know that UConn, I think, is something like a six and a half point favorite. Would you roll with that? Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I think UConn's the better all around team, and they've got arguably the best big man equipped to defend Zach Edey. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, that isn't named Zed Key. So
they're calling Zed Key for tips. They're like, okay, how do you get this guy on?
No, but he, like, I'm, and forgive me, 'cause I'm totally drawing a blank on his name right now, but he's like rapidly elevated his draft stock during this tournament to where I can't imagine that he's not going to be a top 10 pick. And I think that this is, I expect him to cement that perform or that elevation in this game, given that he's playing, you know, the player that most are going to point to as the best player in the tournament. I mean, Edey won the Naismith Award, right?
Yeah, I mean, so, 2 years in a row. Yeah, I think he's
right.
The first
so I think him, you know, I'm not going to say he locks up Edey, but at least mitigating the best player that Purdue has, I would expect them to struggle as they did against Ohio State when that happened. And I don't think that they have the talent elsewhere around the court to measure up.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, I feel like it's similar to the, to the women's national championship, where you've got, you know, one team that's structured. Yeah. Where you got one team that's structured around one guy who, you know, one player who can really just like, you know, do it all and whatever. And they're the best player on the court. Then you've got a better team on the other side who actually like plays better team basketball and you know, has a better system. So, I'm kind of with you.
Six and a half points is enough. If I'm being honest, they were 11 point favorites over Alabama. And I would even think Alabama's a more complete team than Purdue.
I don't disagree with that. And Alabama looked really good in spurts. I mean, they, you know, especially in that first half, it was like, okay, I can see why these guys got here. Like Nate Oates is a really good coach and they were playing really, really sound basketball. It was just, you know, I think talent wise, UConn eventually kind of, you know, pulled it out. But I'm with that. I think that it's going to take a really just like a next level performance from Zach Edey to pull something like that off. And I just don't see that happening. So it would be cool. I honestly, like, you know, most of the time I'm kind of the mind, like, screw the rest of the Big Ten. I hope they lose everything. I don't care. I do think it would be cool to kind of break the very long drought that the Big Ten has had in the NCAA tournament and winning championships, particularly if it's not Michigan doing it. But, you know,
I don't really want it to be Purdue either, though.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, no, I'm kind of with you on that. It's like, okay, if it was, if it's Purdue, I'm okay with it. But, you know, it's not ideal.
I'd rather see, like, Wisconsin win the most boring national championship possible.
God. Yeah, yeah, no, no. That see, that's the thing. Because, no, when Wisconsin was really, when they had it, like, rolling with Bo Ryan, for example, I really wanted the rest of the country to understand what it was like to watch Wisconsin, you know, on a regular basis. You know, watching them win, like, a 42-38 game or something in the national championship, that would have made me very happy. I would have enjoyed that. Because then everybody else would have to suffer along with Ohio State. And that would have been the case, you know, if like Virginia gets back in again.
Well, at least they ruined Calipari's best team ever. Right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Exactly. So I don't know. It'll be an interesting matchup. If Zach Edey pops off, then I think Purdue's got a shot, but honestly, I don't see that happening. And I think UConn wins it pretty easily. So,
yep. You know,
therefore justifying my decision in my bracket to make every Big Ten team lose in the first round. That was mostly just out of spite, not out of any actual analysis on my part. So that's the Dubcast for this week. We'll be back next week to talk about the spring game. We'll talk about the national championship. We'll talk about the NFL draft because that's coming up soon. Lots of stuff to talk about. Lots of faces to look at in a video format. So that'll be cool. But until then, I'm John.
I'm George.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, folks.